So imagine you're up on stage, right? You're pouring your heart out to this massive crowd, and suddenly you realize the audience isn't actually looking at you.
Oh, yeah. Like they're physically there, but they aren't, you know, present.
Exactly. Instead, they are secretly digitizing you through these, like, invisible high-definition cameras hidden right in their sunglasses.
Which is just it's wild to think about, but it's a profound tipping point.
It really is. Today, we are looking at the exact moment where the convenience of all our tech starts, you know, quietly stealing our reality.
Yeah. I mean, what we are seeing across the board right now is that the boundary between our physical world and corporate digital licensing is just entirely collapsing.
Totally. So welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Whether you are the learner joining us to like catch up on the latest market shifts, or maybe a developer prepping for your next sprint, or just someone trying to understand where this heavily digitized world is heading, we're thrilled you're here.
Absolutely. We've got a lot to cover today.
We really do. Our mission today is to unpack a stack of six explosive stories from the July 13th, 2026 edition of Tech & Night. We're tearing through tech infrastructure, gaming, and some massive macro crypto movements.
Right. And they might sound like separate industries, but they're all totally connected.
Yeah, exactly. The through line connecting all of this is the immense tension between extreme digital convenience and, well, the absolute loss of your privacy and true ownership.
And, you know, the stakes have moved way beyond abstract theory at this point. The sources today show how these shifts are literally affecting your daily life.
Right. Whether you're coding massive language models or booting up a console or just like having a private conversation at a music festival.
Yeah, let's actually start with that music festival because it perfectly illustrates the front lines of this whole privacy tension.
Oh, man, it really does. So on July 10th, 2026, at the Real Cool Festival over in Madrid, pop star Lorde was right in the middle of performing her track, Secrets from a Girl.
A great song, by the way.
Oh, totally. So the crowd is engaged, the energy is peaking, and out of nowhere, she just signals her band to stop playing.
Just completely halts the show.
Yeah. She stops the whole thing to call out the festival's main sponsor, telling the audience to, like, literally take off their eyewear.
Right, because she demanded direct eye contact. She specifically told the crowd that she wanted real physical touch and complete mental presence.
Yeah, she was not having it.
No, she outright refused to perform for a hidden camera that was just, you know, recording everything.
Which is wild because the venue was heavily plastered with promotional material for the Ray-Ban Meta glasses. Oh. And even though she didn't name the brand on the mic, I mean, everyone knew exactly what she was targeting.
Oh, for sure. And the internet just immediately caught fire after that.
It exploded. Mm. They hashtag not sexy glasses racked up like 2.3 million tweets in barely 48 hours.
That is massive engagement.
Yeah. But we have to look at the hardware that actually caused this reaction, because we are talking about sunglasses equipped with a 12-megapixel camera, an internal microphone, and an LED recording light that is so incredibly tiny, you practically need a magnifying glass to see it blinking.
Which is the core of the controversy, right? The hardware is specifically designed to be indistinguishable from standard fashion accessories.
Yeah, to me, wearing these feels like walking around with a one-way mirror just strapped to your face.
That's a really good way to put it.
Like, you can observe and capture everyone around you in total high fidelity, but they have zero idea they're being digitized and stored on a server somewhere.
Right. They're just completely in the dark.
But, okay, I want to push back on the panic for a second. Because, I mean, didn't we go through a massive public freakout back in, like, 2013 with Google Glass? And society just kind of moved past it?
Well, yes and no.
Like, when smartphone cameras first became ubiquitous everywhere, people thought privacy was entirely dead. But we just adapted to the fact that everyone has an iPhone in their pocket. Won't society just normalize this new hardware in the exact same way?
I see the parallel you're drawing there. I really do. But there is a fundamental mechanical difference between a smartphone and a pair of smart glasses.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, a smartphone requires a deliberate physical gesture, right? You have to reach into your pocket, pull the device out, hold it up, and physically frame your shot.
Oh, right. Like, it's obvious when someone is taking a picture of you.
Exactly. That physical movement provides a crucial social cue to everyone around you that a recording might be happening. With the Ray-Ban Metas, that vital social cue is completely eliminated.
I mean, the invisibility is basically the main feature.
Precisely. And what Lorde is pushing back against on that stage, and really the anxiety driving those 2.3 million tweets, is the normalization of covert recording.
Because you don't even know what's happening.
Right. When you remove the social cue, you essentially erase the boundary of consent. Imagine you are at a private party or like a sensitive business dinner.
Right, just having a candid conversation.
Yeah, and you suddenly have to calculate whether the person just nodding along with you is secretly live streaming your every word to a cloud server without your knowledge.
Wow, yeah. The psychological weight of that is just exhausting. When you frame it like that, the lack of a gesture changes the entire dynamic of human interaction.
It absolutely does.
We are basically outsourcing our memory to corporate servers, but we're forcing everyone around us to do the same without even asking them.
And, you know, that invisible front-end data collection requires a highly visible, incredibly massive physical infrastructure on the back end to process all of those captured
This
moments.
perfectly leads us to this bizarre paradox in the tech industry right now.
It really is bizarre. We have reached an era where software is rapidly outgrowing the physical limits of our server farms.
Yeah, while hardware companies are simultaneously building physical peripherals that have literally no software to justify their existence.
It's a complete crisis of mismatched innovation.
So let's break that crisis down, starting with the software side outgrowing reality. Anthropic just made a massive announcement.
Oh, this was huge news.
Yeah, they extended free access to Claude Fable 5 until July 19th at 11:59:59 p.m. Pacific time for all their Pro, Max, Team, and Enterprise users.
Which is a very specific cutoff time.
Very specific. Essentially, these tiers can use up to 50% of their weekly limits on Anthropic's newest, most powerful model at no extra charge. And on paper, I mean, it reads like a really generous gift to developers.
It does, but the Forbes report from July 13th reveals the actual mechanics behind the promotion.
Right, it's not just a gift.
Not at all. Anthropic's server infrastructure is literally buckling under the weight of the model. They are extending this staggered free period because they cannot physically handle the compute load of transitioning their entire user base to the paid tiers all at once.
Man, that is crazy. And we have to explain why it's buckling, because the specs on Table 5 are just staggering.
They really are.
It features a 1 million token context window and 128,000 output tokens. It is significantly heavier than its closest competitors, like GPT 5.6 Sol or Gemini 3.5 Flash.
Much heavier.
But for someone listening who doesn't spend their day just staring at API documentation, what does a 1 million token context window actually mean for the physical servers sitting in a data center somewhere?
Okay, to put that architecture into perspective, a million tokens means the AI has to basically hold the equivalent of about three thick novels in its short-term memory for every single question you ask it.
Wait, three novels for just one question?
Exactly. When you upload a massive code base or a giant library of legal documents, the model has to actively retain and cross-reference every single line of that data while generating its
That
response.
is an insane amount of data to juggle at once.
It is, and that requires geometric increases in processing power. The silicon chips run hotter, the energy consumption spikes exponentially, and the physical data centers are just hitting their thermal and electrical limits trying to process it all.
Which explains why they also quietly instituted a 50% increase in the Claude code rate
You're
limits.
right to slow everyone down.
Yeah, they are forcibly throttling how fast developers can send requests just to keep the servers from literally melting down.
Exactly.
So if you are a developer listening to this right now, you know the clock is ticking. You have until July 19th to run your heavy coding projects before the massive tariffs kick in.
And those tariffs are not cheap.
No. Once that deadline passes, the cost jumps to between $10 and $50 per million tokens. The convenience of hyper-advanced AI is about to become an incredibly expensive utility.
It really is. Now, contrast Anthropic's struggle to find enough physical hardware to run their software with what is happening over at
Oh
Nintendo.
man, the exact opposite problem.
Literally the opposite. They have physical hardware with no software.
It is the perfect counterexample. Nintendo just slashed the price of the Switch 2 camera from $40 down to an all-time low of $10.
That's a massive price cut.
Right, and they built this really sleek piece of hardware featuring an 8-megapixel infrared sensor running at 60 frames per second, connecting cleanly via USB-C. Internally, Nintendo projected like a 40% adoption rate among their player base.
Which was incredibly optimistic.
Super optimistic. Instead, they're sitting at a dismal 18%, and the hardware is essentially dead on arrival.
Yeah, because there is no software ecosystem to support it.
None.
To utilize an infrared camera for gameplay, third-party developers have to write highly specific custom code. Major studios like Capcom and Square Enix looked at the peripheral and simply refused to spend the development hours supporting such a niche accessory.
So unless you were specifically playing Star Fox Command 2 to use the head tracking feature to aim your ship, or, I don't know, you're taking selfies in Mario Kart 9, the camera's just a paperweight.
It really is. The developers just didn't show up.
It feels like Anthropic built a sports car so incredibly fast they ran out of road to drive it on, while Nintendo built a shiny new steering wheel that absolutely no one actually wants to hold.
That is a great analogy. It highlights a severe misallocation of resources in the tech sector overall right now.
Totally.
But, you know, to return to Anthropic's dilemma for a second, the immense compute power required to maintain a 1 million token context window doesn't just stress data centers.
Right. It has real-world physical costs.
Exactly. It requires a massive, continuous supply of physical electricity. And right now, the global energy market supplying that power are being violently disrupted by geopolitical conflict.
Which pulls us straight into the macroeconomic data from July 13th. And I have to say, this is where the numbers completely shatter traditional financial logic.
They really do. It's unprecedented.
Yeah. So to provide the objective market context here, strictly looking at the facts, on July 8th, the U.S.-Iran ceasefire that had held since April completely collapsed.
Right.
And under the second Trump administration, the U.S. launched four distinct rounds of airstrikes targeting Iranian military installations. Iran then retaliated by closing the Strait of Hormuz.
And from a purely economic standpoint, we have to recognize that closure is a massive catalyst for the markets.
Oh, jeez.
Approximately 30% of the world's globally traded oil flows directly through that narrow strait. When you choke off that artery, the physical energy markets are forced to price in immediate severe scarcity.
And the traditional markets reacted exactly how you would expect to a major conflict threatening global energy supplies. I mean, Brent crude oil jumped 4.5%, surging from $82 to $86 a barrel almost instantly.
Yeah, totally expected.
And the S&P 500 took a hit, falling 1.8% as equities priced in the instability. But then you look at gold, which actually dropped 2.1%.
Which is very counterintuitive.
Super counterintuitive. And amidst all of this chaos, Bitcoin remained incredibly stable, just hovering around $63,800. It was down a microscopic 0.3% for the day and actually ended the week up 2%.
Yeah, that's the part that is really turning heads.
I have to pause here because honestly, this makes no sense historically. Gold has been the ultimate mattress stuffed with cash during wartime for centuries. When bombs drop, investors buy gold.
Right, that's the classic playbook.
Then why is physical gold dropping while a volatile, purely digital coin is suddenly acting like the only adult in the room?
It's fascinating, right? It represents a structural paradigm shift in how capital seeks safety today, and it's really driven by three distinct mechanisms operating simultaneously.
Okay, lay them out for us.
First, we have to look at changing liquidity cycles. The Federal Reserve is widely expected to cut interest rates in September of 2026.
Right.
Markets are entirely forward-looking, and the anticipation of cheaper borrowing costs historically tends to support the price of risk-on assets, which is keeping Bitcoin buoyant even during a global crisis.
Okay, so cheap money keeps the baseline strong. But what about the lack of volatility during a literal war? That's what I don't get.
That leads to the second and arguably most crucial mechanism, the structural buying from the new Bitcoin ETFs.
Oh, right. Wall Street getting involved?
Exactly. We are talking about massive institutional players, BlackRock, Fidelity, ARK Invest. Before these ETFs existed, the market was primarily driven by human retail traders.
And humans panic.
Exactly. A human investor reads a terrifying headline about the Strait of Hormuz and emotionally hits the sell button out of fear. But these massive ETF algorithms, they do not read the news.
They don't care about headlines.
No, they are programmed to blindly dollar cost average and accumulate assets every single day, regardless of global events. They just absorb the incoming supply like a vacuum.
Wow.
This creates a massive price agnostic floor underneath the asset, effectively removing the emotional volatility that usually crashes markets during geopolitical panic.
So they act as like an unfeeling shock absorber for the entire asset class.
That's exactly what they were doing. And The third factor is Bitcoin's fundamental architecture regarding international sanctions.
How so?
Well, the Bitcoin network operates entirely outside the SWIFT banking system. It does not rely on correspondent banks to clear a transaction.
Right. It's totally decentralized.
Yeah. So if a nation state is locked out of moving physical gold or US dollars due to heavy sanctions, their central bank can still transfer billions of dollars in Bitcoin across the globe in 10 minutes without needing a Western bank's permission.
That is wild.
Financial analysts are openly floating the theory that heavily sanctioned nations may be actively using Bitcoin behind the scenes to bypass restrictions and keep their economies functioning.
That is such a wild reality to process. I mean, we are watching Bitcoin transition in real time from this, speculative tech stock into a truly uncorrelated asset.
It really is.
It is completely untethered from the usual panic triggers. Sovereign nations are recognizing the utility of decentralized, permissionless networks to evade control and keep capital flowing.
But, consider the flip side of that equation.
Okay.
While sovereign nations are leveraging decentralized crypto to evade external control, the world's largest mega corporations are busy building their own centralized crypto networks to exert total control over their consumers.
Which is a perfect segue. That brings us straight to our final block of stories from Tech & Night. Sony Bank's aggressive move into stablecoins, perfectly timed with the violent death of physical media.
The synergy between these two stories is just ruthless.
It really is. So first, the crypto play. Sony Bank, which is the actual banking arm of the PlayStation conglomerate, just received conditional approval from the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in the U.S.
And getting the nod from a federal banking regulator like the OCC is a massive hurdle to clear.
Oh, yeah.
It signals that Sony is dead serious about overhauling their financial plumbing.
Absolutely. They are partnering with Bastion Platforms and working through a subsidiary called Connexia Trust to launch a dollar-pegged stablecoin in 2027.
Which is huge.
And this digital currency is targeted directly at their captive audience of 108 million PlayStation Network users. And honestly, the underlying economics of this move are brilliant.
They really are, from a corporate perspective.
Right. Because right now, when you buy a brand new $70 game on the PlayStation Store using your credit card, Sony has to pay Visa or MasterCard an interchange fee of about 2.9% plus 30 cents.
Which adds up incredibly fast.
Yeah, that means roughly $2.30 vanishes from Sony's pocket on every single transaction just to use the traditional banking rails.
But if Sony transitions players to using a proprietary stablecoin, they bypass the Visa and MasterCard settlement layers entirely.
They just cut them right out.
Exactly. They process the transaction on their own internal blockchain ledger, which drops that $2 transaction cost down to fractions of a penny.
I mean, right now, buying a digital game is like paying a heavy toll to Visa every time you drive out of your own driveway. Sony's stablecoin isn't just a new car. It is Sony building their own private digital highway where they exclusively own all the toll booths.
That's a great way to look at it.
And on top of saving billions in fees, it opens up frictionless global access, right? Gamers in markets dealing with heavy currency devaluation or strict banking controls, places like Argentina, Turkey, Nigeria, and Iran, can bypass their local failing banking systems entirely.
Yeah, they just load up crypto wallets and buy games directly.
Exactly. It's brilliant for them.
It is the ultimate frictionless payment system. But we have to look at what Sony is taking away while they offer this new convenience.
Right. There's always a catch.
Always. At the exact same time they are building this digital financial highway, they are aggressively bulldozing the physical alternatives.
The timing is impossible to ignore. On July 10th, Best Buy officially ended all physical game sales nationwide.
Just completely stopped.
Yeah, and Walmart followed suit by slashing their physical disc shelf space by 60%. The physical disc is practically dead at this point.
It really is.
But okay, I have to stop and argue the po-convenience side here for a second because I haven't bought a physical disc in over 5 years.
Really? 5 years.
Yeah. The convenience of an all-digital ecosystem is genuinely unbeatable. My entire digital library follows me seamlessly to any console I log into. I don't have to worry about scratching a disc. I get instant access to major releases at midnight on launch day without standing in line at some mall.
Well, sure, the convenience is great.
And the seasonal digital sales are incredible. I'm regularly picking up AAA titles for 75% off. If handing over technical physical ownership is the price of admission for all that? I mean, I'm taking that deal every single time. It feels like a fair trade to me.
Well, it feels like a fair trade today, while the servers are still actively running and the corporate goodwill is high.
Okay, fair point.
But you are ignoring the actual mechanics of how digital licensing functions. When you buy a digital game, the code on your hard drive is wrapped in DRM, Digital Rights Management.
Right.
Every single time you boot up that game, the software has to send a ping over the internet to a central Sony server to verify that your account still holds the license.
And if that server says no, or I guess if the server doesn't exist anymore, the game simply won't launch, even though the files are sitting right there on my hard drive.
Exactly. Because you do not actually own the game. You own a conditional temporary license to ask permission to play it.
Wow. Buying a digital game right now is basically like buying a house, but the builder legally keeps the right to change the locks whenever they feel like it.
That is exactly what it is. And the Dutch Consumer Group is currently suing PlayStation over this exact mechanism.
Oh, really? Good for them.
Yeah, they are arguing in court that Sony's transition to a purely digital storefront gives the corporation monopolistic power. Without a secondary market of used games at local shops to compete with, Sony can unilaterally dictate pricing.
Which makes sense. No competition means they set the rules.
Exactly. And furthermore, they can shut down those authentication servers whenever a game stops being profitable to maintain, which instantly bricks the media you paid for.
And the Dutch Consumer Group actually brought the receipts in this lawsuit, too. They specifically pointed to the Discovery Plus wipeout in 2024 as the precedent.
Oh, yeah. That was a disaster.
Thousands of PlayStation users logged in one morning to find that hundreds of dollars worth of TV shows they had quote-unquote purchased were completely wiped from their libraries.
Just gone.
Yeah, simply because a corporate licensing contract between Sony and Discovery had expired. The users did absolutely nothing wrong, but their media was vaporized overnight.
It is the ultimate corporate rug pull. And to combat this, the European Union is currently drafting legislation to force tech companies to respect consumer rights in the digital age.
Thank goodness someone is stepping in.
Right. They are proposing a digital ownership law, which mandates that a digital purchase must legally carry the exact same irrefutable ownership rights as a physical purchase.
That'd be huge.
They are also pushing for a required digital used market, forcing platforms to allow users to resell their digital licenses to other players. And most importantly, they are proposing a permanent archiving rule.
Which means what exactly?
It would require companies to provide DRM-free offline copies of software so you can still use it even if their servers go dark permanently.
I mean, that would solve the entire problem right there. But of course, predictably, Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo are spending millions lobbying heavily against all these laws.
Oh, fighting tooth and nail.
Yeah, fighting to maintain total control over the digital ecosystem.
Because true ownership threatens their recurring revenue models. I mean, I challenge you and the listener to mentally audit your own digital libraries right now.
Okay, I'm thinking about it.
Look at your downloaded games, your massive movie collections in the cloud, your expensive productivity software. If the central authentication servers went dark tomorrow due to a bankruptcy, a hack, or just a change in corporate strategy, what do you actually physically possess?
Man.
The convenience of your digital life today is entirely precariously dependent on the profit motives of a corporation tomorrow.
Wow. That mental audit is genuinely sobering. You think you've built this massive collection over a decade, but you really just have a long list of temporary receipts.
That's all it is.
Let's pull all of these threads together because we have covered incredible ground today.
We really have.
We started with Lord fighting for basic physical privacy against the invisible, normalized surveillance of smart glasses. We looked at the sheer physical limits of innovation, breaking down how Anthropic's massive AI models are melting servers, while Nintendo builds hardware for a software ecosystem that literally doesn't exist.
Right. And then we examine the macroeconomic anomalies, analyzing how automated ETF algorithms and sanction-proof architecture are turning Bitcoin into a digital safe haven while the physical world faces all this geopolitical conflict.
And we ended by unpacking the slow, deliberate execution of true ownership as corporations like Sony build frictionless digital currencies while ensuring you never actually own the media you buy with them.
Yeah, and the overarching lesson from all of today's sources is that we absolutely must look past the marketing. Technologies that are aggressively sold to us purely on the basis of convenience, whether it's hands-free recording that removes social friction, instant digital downloads that save a trip to the store, or corporate stablecoins that bypass banking fees, they can effortlessly pivot into tools of restriction and surveillance.
It is the invisible cost of the modern era. Which leaves us with a lingering question for you to ponder long after this deep dive ends.
It's a big one.
If our spontaneous memories are quietly captured and stored on Meta servers, and our financial energy sits in a corporate-controlled stablecoin, and our entire media library is nothing more than a temporary license pinging a cloud server. Does the concept of private property even exist for the average person in the digital age?
Or have we traded our actual ownership for the ultimate convenience of being perpetual renters of our own lives?
A heavy, necessary question that every single consumer needs to answer for themselves. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the July 13th, 2026 sources.
Keep auditing what you own, keep questioning the systems built around you, and we will catch you next time.